Welcome to Enabled, the weekly program about people just like you who are dealing with issues of vision loss. The program is designed to encourage you through news you can use, inspirational stories, and interviews. I'm Nancy Zimmer, your host for Enabled. Thank you for joining me. I want to introduce you to my dog, Roxy. She is a long-haired miniature dachshund, just as cute as you can imagine. She's blind. Roxy doesn't seem to mind being blind. I guess you could say she has adapted very well. She uses her long, pointy nose like a white cane, swinging her head back and forth to keep herself right on course. She doesn't have a guide dog to help her. She has a guide human. That would be me. While thinking about how Roxy has adapted to her environment, I discovered other animal species that have really adapted to their blindness, and you'll hear about some of them today. The blind river dolphin, the blind mole rat, the blind cave fish. Interesting stuff from the animal kingdom. First of all, from earthtouchnews.com, a column about endangered species. Good news for India's blind river dolphins. This was written by Sarah Kirtz. It starts out by saying, in the early 1980s, nearly 5,000 Ganges River dolphins swam in India's river systems. Today, it's difficult to spot even one. The strange creatures, often called blind dolphins because their eyes lack lenses, are native to one of the most densely populated regions on the planet. They share their habitat with some 400 million human beings. To put that into perspective, every fish-seeking dolphin in the Ganges River Basin has roughly 220,000 human mouths to compete with for that food. Those are tough odds, and they've pushed the species into rapid decline over the past century. But now a new survey, the largest ever conducted on dolphins in the area, suggests the animals may be holding up better than we thought. There's a campaign called My Ganga, My Dolphin, and this is conducted by the World Wildlife Foundation, the WWF, with the help of local fishing communities. And they have successfully surveyed a 3,350-kilometer stretch of India's Ganga River. Now, the word Ganga is another name for the Ganges in northeast India. The survey took 6,000 hours and involved 21 teams, but in the end, 1,263 of those endangered dolphins were found, nearly twice the number reached in previous counts. Here's a quote, "It's not as simple as saying their numbers have doubled," cautions WWF India's Suresh Babu. In part, the jump can be chalked up to a larger survey area, but it could be that in certain stretches of the river, a breeding population has established itself, he says. The survey results highlight interesting patterns that could help us protect these animals in coming years. Because the dolphin is an indicator species, its health is a good reflection of the well-being of the entire river ecosystem. A quote, "Some stretches of the river have reported an increase, while there has been a decrease in others, and the reasons for that need to be analyzed," explains Mr. Babu from the WWF. "It's possible that areas with low dolphin counts are polluted or experiencing some kind of imbalance." During the count, the team also interviewed local villagers to better understand the public's perception of their aquatic neighbors. By mapping the responses with the new population data, they will be able to put critical education programs in place. And a quote, "What needs to be realized is that there is a lot of connection that people in these habitats have with these animals," said Mr. Babu. "If they are not involved in conservation, I don't see how it can work." Listed as an endangered species on the IUCN Red List since 1996, the Gangetic dolphin, and I'll tell you its Latin name in case you're interested, it's called Platanista gangetica. This is for the Latin name for the Gangetic dolphin. This Gangetic dolphin remains mysterious, not for lack of effort on the part of researchers, but because it's a notoriously difficult animal to study. Unlike the dolphins we see out in the open ocean, freshwater dolphins prefer to spend their time in the deepest parts of their habitat. They use their flukes to trawl on the muddy bottom for prey that's hiding in the sediment. This makes topside surveys particularly challenging. The only time you will spot a river dolphin is when it comes up for a quick breath of air. Though some protections are now in place, the few remaining gangetic dolphins are still poached for their meat and oil, which are prized in traditional medicine and used as fishing bait. Entanglement in fishing gear and habitat disruption caused by irrigation canals and dam building are also major threats. It takes females up to 10 years to reach sexual maturity, and one calf is typically born only every 2 or 3 years, making the prospect of a thriving breeding population particularly exciting for everyone involved in that survey. This is only the first leg of an ongoing analysis of the larger basin, and we don't have the full picture just yet, but Mr. Babu from the World Wildlife Foundation is encouraged by the success of the work thus far. With this count, he says, and ending this part of the article, with this count and data gathered from our community, we hope that a robust conservation strategy can be developed in the months to come. Next, still about river dolphins, I have some information on a couple of research attempts in the 1960s. These blind river dolphins were actually captured and held in captivity for scientists to study. This information comes from the dolphinproject.net. The headline reads, "The Captive History of Blind River Dolphins." Strange and prehistoric in appearance. The Indus River Dolphin, this is located in a little different area of India, the Indus River dolphin, known in Pakistan as Bulan or Susu, S-U-S-U, this is the Hindi word for them. These Indus River dolphins are the most threatened among the river dolphin family. Native to the brackish lower-level Indus River system in Pakistan, these blind dolphins use their echolocation to hunt and, quote-unquote, see in their murky world. With only an estimated 1,100 individuals left and inhabiting a fifth of their former range, they have fallen victim to incidental bycatch from gill nets, polluted waters from human waste, and agricultural runoff. Reckless fishing has significantly reduced food availability. Now, just for your information, the Indus River actually rises in the Himalaya Mountains and then runs along the border between Pakistan and India. It flows into the Arabian Sea right near the Pakistani city of Karachi. And the article continues by saying, on top of that, hydropower and irrigation dams only add to their troubles. According to marine mammal specialist Gil Bollock, there is now a recorded link between the Indus River dolphins' disappearance and the construction of irrigation barges, which trap and isolate the dolphins, preventing them from more extensive foraging and breeding. Very little is known about these enigmatic cetaceans, and minimal research has been conducted into their behavior and way of life, given their rarity and less than ideal water conditions in which to study them. At one point, from the end of the 1960s through the mid-1970s, a handful of Indus River dolphins were kept in captivity in order to better understand how they lived in such silty, murky waters. The earliest attempt, though, was made in 1878 when Scottish zoologist and anatomist John Anderson captured a young Indus dolphin near Dhaka in Bangladesh, and he kept it in a bath filled with fresh water for 10 days near his home in Calcutta. He fed the young dolphin live fish, which it readily ate. Now, no other details were written on how this one died or even if it was released. Now, this was back in 1878. Fast forward now, almost 100 years later, to November of 1968. An expedition was carried out by Steinhardt Aquarium in San Francisco. Their destination was near Sukkur, S-U-K-K-U-R. This is located in western Pakistan. Their mission was to capture Indus River dolphins for study. Led by aquarium director and biologist for California Academy of Sciences, Earl S. Harold, along with associates Robert Brownell, Frederick Fry, and Elkin Morris, three female Susu, this, remember, is the Hindi name for the blind dolphin, three of them were captured by local fishermen between November 4th and the 8th. And these are fishermen who normally caught the cetaceans to eat. Faced with the problem now of shipping them halfway around the world, the capture team from California stopped briefly and put the three dolphins into a freshwater swimming pool in Karachi. There, the men discovered the dolphins' curious habit of swimming on their sides with one pectoral flipper touching the pool floor. After taking another little pit stop in Tokyo, the dolphins finally completed their 12,000-mile journey by being placed unceremoniously into their barren tank. Studied mainly through a porthole, now this is in San Francisco, remember, in the tank, Mr. Harold and his team observed how surprisingly limber and vocal the dolphins were, emitting a constant stream of buzzes and clicks. It was also hypothesized that while the, as they say, the rudimentary eye lacked the lens, their anatomical evidence suggests that the eye may serve as a light sensor, given that the dolphins typically lived in fast-flowing, murky water. All three river dolphins lived at the Steinhardt Aquarium in San Francisco for a little over a month. One of them lasted for 44 days. The necropsies for the two larger dolphins revealed that they had died from pneumonic infection, most likely brought on by the stress of capture and transport, while the smaller Susu died following injuries to her lower jaw during capture. Confinement in an inadequate tank surely didn't help matters. The dolphins' skeletons and one skull would later be prepared, and they are still kept at the aquarium in San Francisco. For Mr. Harold, the dolphins' brief time in captivity was enough, as he eventually compiled his observations on their behavior and physiology into a report published as the cover story for the December 1969 issue of Science magazine. In May 1970, another female Susu was reportedly captured in Sukkur, arriving at the Steinhardt Aquarium on May 22nd. She was nicknamed Cindy. She was thought to be a yearling, and she lived at the aquarium until July of 1971. That's a little over a year. Her cause of death was not disclosed. While the Steinhardt Aquarium was preoccupied with their research, another in-depth study was underway probing the echolocation and sensory abilities of the Susu. In late 1969, Swiss neuroanatomist and director of the Brain Anatomy Institute, Giorgio Poleri, traveled to Pakistan to capture his own Indus River dolphins to study their physiology, sonar, and navigational capabilities. Originally a proponent of keeping cetaceans in captivity for research, this long-term project would eventually plant seeds of doubt in Giorgio Poleri that would later turn him into a critic. November 10th through the 20th, this was in 1969, this was a hands-off exploratory observational trip. Poleri listened to Susu chatter through hydrophones on the shore. He was on the shore. The Susus were in the water. Or else they floated along with local fishermen in boats along the Gila Bil River in an area east of India. He recorded detailed notes on their foraging behavior, social groupings, and activities. He learned the dolphins were most active during the day, but preferred to hunt in the evenings. They swam in scattered pods of 8 to 10 individuals and were only visible when surfacing to breathe. Females had much longer, slender beaks compared to the males. With the newfound knowledge, Poleri returned in December with the intent to capture dolphins, having managed to obtain a Swiss air plane with suitable space for bringing live animals back into Europe. He was from Switzerland, by the way. The first capture operation ended in disaster. Using a small platoon of fishing canoes and nets, Poleri and the local fishermen rounded up a pod of 7 dolphins and captured them one by one using a conical couleurie net. Even with the careful preparations, 5 of them died from shock, including 3 pregnant females, before they could even be hauled into the boats. The 2 surviving males were temporarily held in a makeshift pool before being released. Another 12 animals were captured for examination in the second volume of a book called Investigations of Cetacea. Poleri made a disturbing note that, as he said, some animals were killed for purposes of post-mortem studies. This was accompanied by either narcotics, where, as they described, a plastic bag containing cotton pads soaked in ether was placed over their heads. Time of death took 45 seconds to 1 minute in weak animals, 4 to 7 minutes in stronger specimens. Another three Indus dolphins, two females and a male, would be captured alive for further studies at the Brain Anatomy Institute in Bern, Switzerland. They were packed into plywood crates filled with foam. The destined trio were laid on their sides, kept cool with wet muslin and regular waterings, and had their bedding changed. For 70 hours, they were transported in order, first by motorboat, by lorry, by train, by Land Rover, and finally by air during the Christmas holiday. Halfway to their destination, the dolphins were placed into a hotel's children's pool for more than a day, not far from the Karachi airport. Then, for reasons unknown, one of the females was left behind as the other two were packed up and taken to their last stop. Once they arrived in Bern on December 28th, the rooms that held the tanks were modified to mimic the dolphins' original environment, similar water temperature and chemistry, as well as the room's atmospheric humidity, which was raised to 70 or 80%, with the exception of the tanks themselves. They were made featureless in order to make it easier for Polari and his team to study the animals. It would take 2 days before the cetacean pair would eat, and luckily they were offered live fish. During the next 2 months, the pair were studied intensely. Live fish were given twice a day in their tank, keeping their hunting abilities sharp. They touched the tank bottom with the edge of their flippers, always, and echolocated constantly, even when they were more than familiar with the walls and spatial dimensions. Now, this is in contrast, harbor porpoises stopped echolocating after 14 days and only resumed when their physical environment was altered. Recalling the discoveries made in William Johnson's expose titled The Rose-Tinted Menagerie, Polari found the Susu could detect, quote, balls 2 millimeters in diameter at a distance of 7 meters, as well as distinguishing between materials, whether an object is made of wood or stone. And in addition, they could actually identify the species of the fish that was before them, and they could tell whether it was alive or dead. In the first few weeks of their stay, Polari hand-fed the dolphins to see whether he and his colleagues could gain their trust. During the fifth week, he had to enter the tank to catch the female, who had received a small cut on her beak, possibly from hurting herself against the tank wall. As he held her to put antibiotic ointment on the wound, the male Susu began to panic and swam more frantically around the tank. Polari released the female quickly to avoid having her companion ram the tank wall or go into a total collapse. From then on, the pair were wary of their captors. Given their featureless environment, anything that was placed into the tank, such as a hydrophone, became an item of interest. Both dolphins enjoyed rubbing the device along the lengths of their toothy beaks. In several instances, they would let it hang down into their throats. This is like a microphone hanging into their throats, seemingly trying to swallow it. How long the pair lasted is not exactly known, for such details were never published in Polari's own reports in a book called Investigations of Cetacea, nor were they published in his book called Secrets of the Blind Dolphins. Nonetheless, a second expedition to Pakistan was undertaken in February of 1972. Then a large male Susu was accidentally caught in fishing nets off Trapu Island, but died shortly after his arrival in Switzerland. Poor weather in Pakistan prevented Polari and his team from capturing more animals. But they returned later in December. 4 animals were captured from an Indus River once more, including 2 juvenile females, a subadult male and adult female, and brought back to Bern in Switzerland. One of the juveniles died within days, while the other one died after 1 year in captivity. The adults lasted surprisingly longer. The male lived until February of 1976, the female till March of 78. Causes of death were never publicized for the 7 dolphins that were held at Bern University. Now, years later, Polari turned over a new leaf, and he became one of the most vocal critics of crustacean captivity. In the book called The Rose-Tinted Menagerie, he gave a frank reflection of his project. He said, "I feel ashamed at having kept dolphins at the Brain Anatomy Institute. I feel ashamed for my lost dolphins. They were nothing more than an alibi for scientific research, since keeping dolphins in artificial conditions can do little else than produce artificial scientific results. 4 of my dolphins died, 3 from skin disease caused by chlorine in the water and from consuming fish polluted with mercury and parasites, and 1 died after breaking its beak." Polari was convinced, however, that his efforts did create some good. His studies and findings would convince the Pakistani government to protect the dolphins. A national park was created that included the same stretch of river the dolphins inhabited. For a brief period of time, the dolphins were granted federal protection. However, their fate is now uncertain as industrial agriculture and irrigation methods have been introduced to the local communities that live along the Indus. Well, now we'll move on to another strange species, and this would be the blind mole rat. This information was described by the National Geographic in the article titled, "How Do Blind Mole Rats Avoid Cancer?" This was written by Monica Joshi. Their eyes and ears seem to be missing, but that's not the only thing that makes blind mole rats an odd bunch. The furry rodents are also highly resistant to cancer, a new study says, raising the possibility of new cancer treatments for humans. Researchers Aaron Avivi, Imad Shams, and Irina Manoff of the University of Haifa in Israel conducted a 2-part study to determine whether blind mole rats are resistant to chemically induced cancers and if their bodies can suppress tumors. 12 blind mole rats were treated with 2 potent carcinogens, 3-MCA and DMBA, and only 1 of them developed a tumor. When the same experiment was conducted on mice and rats, those animals all developed malignant tumors, according to the study published August 9th in the journal BMC Biology. In the second part of the study, when cancer cells were placed into a medium with healthy blind mole rat cells, the cancer cells stopped dividing and even decreased in number. This did not occur in the case of mice and rat cells, leading the team to conclude that blind mole rat cells release a substance that inhibits cancer from growing. The next step is to pinpoint this unknown substance. A quote, "If we succeed to identify, isolate, and clean the substance their cells secrete, we are on the way to testing it clinically and hopefully reaching a medicine for people," Avivi said by email. Living long and prospering. Previous studies on blind mole rats and their relatives, the naked mole rats, have revealed similar cancer resistance. A quote, "Investigating these cancer-resistant creatures is extremely important." This was said by Vera Gorbanova from the University of Rochester, right here where this program originates. In 2012, Gorbanova's team, which was not involved in this new study, found that blind mole rat cells were able to eliminate precancerous cells by secreting a protein called interferon beta. Well, who knew that these strange rats could teach us so much about defeating cancer? Finally, another unusual species, information from the National Geographic, Mexico's blind cave fish. If you don't use it, you lose it. At least this appears to be the case for a blind cave fish found in Mexico in the southern U.S., known as Astyanax mexicanus. Astyanax mexicanus. Descended from an eyed surface fish over long periods of time, the subterranean form of the same species has adapted to darkness, accumulating new mutations that make them blind. As a result, the Astyanax mexicanus is a freshwater fish that is currently found in 2 forms, cave fish and surface fish. Both forms are omnivores and approximately the same size, about 3 inches. But unlike the surface fish, the cave fish are blind albino insomniacs and have taste buds on the outside of their lower jaw. The cave fish and surface fish can interbreed, which makes them an ideal species to investigate the genetic basis of their differences. A quote, "Evolution is harder to study than laboratory science because frequently important adaptations arise only once." This is according to scientist Richard Borowski, a professor of biology at New York University. He continues, for example, the ability of birds to fly was an evolutionary adaptation that happened only once in history. However, in the case of these fish, different cave populations have repeatedly and independently adapted to cave life. Basically, if a surface fish colonizes in a cave environment, eventually they will lose their eyesight and pigmentation. Because different genes are changed in independent colonizations, it is possible to hybridize cave fish from different caves and restore vision in their offspring. Borowski says this recurring adaptation comes about through genetic mutation. Over the past few months, biologists have been searching for the genetic mutations that cause blindness and skin transparency using a genetic website called ensemble.com to crowdsource the fish's entire genome. Borowski estimates that between 15 and 20 different genes have been altered by mutation in each cave population, leading to the loss of vision. And then there's a quote from him to end this article. Through the use of genetic research, biologists can locate many of the genes responsible for normal eye development. There are tons of questions that people are interested in knowing, and we have people that are investigating, Borowski adds. Now we are able to look at the genome and see the standout pieces that really make this fish different. Well, here's a quote for you to think about as we end this program. It's not the strongest of the species that survives, nor the most intelligent that survives. It is the one that is most adaptable to change. That was said by Charles Darwin, an English naturalist who is best known for his contributions to the science of evolution. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great week. You've been listening to Enabled, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. Our technical director is Maureen Rich, and I'm Nancy Zimmer. I hope you'll join me again next week for more updates and information and encouraging stories. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can listen to it at our website, wxxi.org.